giving me that this subject. It's either a very simple subject or a very complicated one. As I will show you how simple it is and how complicated it is. But before that, let me take a count. How many of you come from science background? Oh, majority. Okay, any comes from non-science background at all? Yeah, what? What do you do? You study Arabic or something? Okay, second question. How many of you think that evolution is right? Ah, beautiful. Hey, you got something common. How many of you think that creationism is right? Things are created, you know? Excellent. You make good Buddhists. You know why I say that? Because Buddhism is all about evolution. Right? Changes. Evolution means change. Anyway, since I know which way you're heading, as I said before, there are two ways you can look at that question. One is very simple. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I think a simple way out, right? Which a lot of people, not you, very simple people, you are very good because you are all believe in evolution. And people who believe in evolution are not simple in their thinking, right? As I'll show afterwards. But if you are simple-minded, then you have got to stick on to certain things and what people tell you. There are a lot of people who talk about it. It's the creationist view. It says in the universe, according to their belief, things are created, right, by a great being. And some put a date as 4,004 years before Christ. That means 4,004 plus 2013, you work that out, okay? 6,000 over years ago. And if you ask them which comes first, chicken or the egg, did I hear somebody say the egg comes first? Right. You're going to be very disappointed. Because according to the books which this creationist use, it's chicken that comes first. There's evidence of it in the books. Right. It's bad. When the great spirit wants to create something, all of a sudden he says, oh, there's nothing, I better create something. So they start to point there, there's an elephant, point there, there's a pig, point there, there's some forest, point there, there's a thing. And then lights come out and things like that. That's the sort of popular belief the creationists have. And they are quite popular in America and also to a certain extent in Australia. Now, and in the creationist books, this spirit creates animals. So which means that animals come first. Right? It doesn't talk about the spirit creating eggs. So that answers your question. Which comes first, chicken or the egg, if you are believers. But unfortunately, none of you believe that way. Right? So I can't use that argument to satisfy your desire. Right? Let's look at the other way, the evolutionist way, the scientific way, as we call it. Now, what does science tell you? When you tell a scientist about chicken and egg going round and round like that, they laugh at you. Says you got no knowledge, no wisdom at all. Because if you look at it, right now it's all right. You get a white chicken, it produces white eggs. Then the white eggs hatch out, becomes a white chicken, right? Leghorn will give you a leghorn egg, and so on. It goes around like that, just for the time being. But you go back 1,000 years ago, there's no such thing as a white chicken, the leghorn. The white leghorn is made by breeding. So they get this white chicken and therefore you get white leghorns. Now for you who study genetics, you know that. It's like that. But if you go back 1,000,000 years ago, was that chicken or not? No. Possibly not. Right? So when does the chicken appear? So it's a lot more complicated than that. So you got to find out. You go back. It goes back to the time when there's primitive birds. They call it they wrote something. Right? They found it in archaeology. So there's a time when they start to produce eggs, but It's need to an animal to produce eggs. And slowly you go back. These animals were just reptiles. And then go back, they were like aquatic animals, like fish. You go back and so on and so on. So where's the chicken? Where's the egg? So, in other words, that sort of study is very scientific, but still doesn't give any answers. And so, I would consider this rather a dumb question. Not that you're dumb, Emily, but you're being sucked into all this dumbness. Right? We get sucked into all these things. One day I was walking past a few friends and they were arguing about whether Buddhists are idolaters or not. You know what idolaters are? They worship these images and all this. Then they say, "Oh, Jim, you're a Buddhist teacher, you should know." Because there are two schools. You know, one says Buddhists are idolaters, but we are not idolaters, and so on and so forth. So they asked me whether the Buddhists are idolaters or not. So I said, why not? Yes, we are idolaters. We pray to an image. Then, but we are not praying to the image and this. I said, what is that in front of you when you pray? And then finally I asked them, who says it's wrong to be idolaters? Who says it's wrong to pray to to images? Then they cited the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims. Then I asked them, are you Jew? Are you a Christian? Are you a Muslim? So it's all right for Buddhists to pray to these sort of things. Right? So this is the logic now. When you look at the logic of this chicken and egg as a flat thing, it's just like walking. You know, have you seen those drawings of the impossible drawings? It's about this staircase. You go up, up, and then you come back again. You go up, up, and come back again. Right? So this is like that. Now, apparently there's some flaw in that question. Right? Because it doesn't really prove anything at all. And I was asked this question a long time ago. Right? When I was a young student like you. But this guy who asked me the question, he has got something behind that question. You see? He wants to sell me some religion. Right? So because he wants to tell me that things are created and all these things, so he put me this question, and I went to think a few days. I said, I tried to work it out. And I said, I couldn't work out the solution. So I said, no, I can't work out. You have the answer? He said, we have the answer. He said, God created everything. You must believe in God. You must believe in our books. But unless you believe in it, it doesn't hold water at all. So then what is it? You can tell yourself, if chicken and egg, when is an egg, when is a chicken? From the Buddhist way, we have got a third way out, right? Rather than going to a long scientific way. We say, don't ask that sort of things. What does it benefit you? If you look at the Buddhist scripture, there are 10 things to which the Buddha would not answer. Right? The Buddha kept quiet about it. It's about these sort of things. Very, very abstract thing which doesn't have any answer at all. But unfortunately, a lot of Buddhists love these sort of things. Right? You heard about the Zen people? What's the sound of one hand clapping? Right? I think that's a very dumb question. One hand can't clap. How do you clap with one hand? So you can't clap. Where does the sound come from? Same thing with people who believe in ghosts. Now, my favorite topic, ghosts. Now, when they sit down there, the door suddenly crack, 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 it opens. And they say, there's a ghost coming in. And you see, there's nothing, but there's a ghost there. You can't see the ghost. For me, I was just wondering, use your scientific brain and see. For you to enter a room, you must have a physical body, right? If I don't have a body, you have become thin air, I don't have to open the door to come in. Isn't it? So that's why, now go back to this Buddhist way of thinking. Logic. Right? But again, logic sometimes can have its flaws. Right? This is very logical. Right? Has its flaws as well. For example, I give you some very famous, our simple but famous algebra here. Right? Sorry. This is extremely logical. But you can shift a little bit and say, I am a human being, you are a human being, therefore I am you. So this is the sort of thing which the Buddha called mere logic in his scripture. Right? Something very simple, which is very logical, but you're actually putting two different set of things in it. Right? So anyway, we talk about all these things. That's why when we go into this sort of chicken and the egg business, you can never get an answer. For example, I ask you, when is the Buddha image a Buddha image? Or assuming it's made from a piece of wood, all right? When is it a Buddha image? You've got to start somewhere, isn't it? So now you see it's a Buddha image. But when the wood cover is carving from a block of wood, it was a block of wood, right? And before that, it was part of a tree. And before the tree grew, it's part of a seedling. Right? So this is the more complex way. And sometimes these sort of things, it boggles the mind. And if we use our unenlightened, simple mind, we arrive with all sorts of conclusions. And it becomes our idea. And when it becomes ideas, then we start to have different camps of ideas. So we start to have this difference in things like that. We argue, we fight over it, and then you can do a lot of problems. So sometimes when you get this sort of question, or like when some Zen people ask you, what's the sound of one hand clapping? Just tell them, one hand can't clap. You need two hands to clap. Okay? So it's useless to answer. Useless even to think about it. You're wasting your time if you think about it. And lucky thing for Buddhists, we don't think in this line. The Buddha has never encouraged us to think in this line. Your line of thinking will be very different if you study the Dharma. But lucky thing, I think you got a way out. The next part that you say, link. The link to other human beings, other people, and so on. So I'll talk more on the link rather than answering this question, because if you ask me the answer, I don't know. If you ask anybody, even I tell you my friend's answer, you wouldn't like it. No? God created everything, so God created the chicken first. And you go back, you grumble at the thing, you know, I'm wrong and all these things. Right? So if you go in the scientific way, you need to have a whole team of people to come and find an answer for you. Or even then, they still can't give you an answer because science has never given answers. Okay, then we start talking about this link. Right? Now, this link, where does this link come from? Now, when you talk about link, what do you mean? When you have got, say, take it a simple case when two persons are there, person A and person B, what links them? The linkage comes from the way we think. So it comes from the working of the mind. Now, even if I don't say anything, if I walk along the street, I see you, or I see a person, I say, I like him or I like her. That's my link, the first linkage you have. But where does this come from? It has to come from somewhere in our way of thinking. And the thinking itself comes from the mind. In the Buddha's teachings, in the Dhammapada, the first two lines is about mind. Everything is the product of your mind. And if you go deeper into it, what do you mean by this mind? Right? This mind has got four parts in it. A process of four different parts. The consciousness, the sort of sensation you receive, and you react to sensation by having this perception, and then the volition. The volition is the most important, the will. Right? The way it gives you the idea. When you look at a person, you feel the person is pleasant, that's a sensation. When you feel that the person is not pleasant, that's also a sensation. When you see a person who is pleasant, then you like the person. It's natural. When you see a person who is unpleasant, gives you an unpleasant feeling, that is, you start to develop this aversion. Right? And then the aversion can become dislike. Supposing you you walk around and the person just bumps into you again. You start to have that aversion already. Right? Because that bumping, you perceive it as something to be very rude. Right? And because we think it's rude, therefore that person bumps into me, he's rude. And what comes with this thinking of being rude or before that? It's the dislike you have. So that's the way we work. We connect people through our volition, through that will within us. But how does this will develop? Now, we can say that the Buddha spent almost 3/4 of his lifetime teaching things like that, psychology. Not modern psychology, but a very practical psychology. Right? Teaches you the way you think. And because the way you think, it affects your action. You act according to your thinking. Right? If you think, I'm going to drink tea, you will drink tea. But then halfway through, I can't drink tea in front of them. So again, what I think, I stop drinking. Or I stop going for the tea. Right? Am I right or not? So it's a very simple thing. If you go on step by step, you can start to see that. That's how we create phenomena within us. Everything we do is what they call a phenomenon. Every single thing we do is a phenomenon. Right from the very beginning. And again, when you talk about that, which where it all starts. And in the teachings, we start from that very person. That means me or you, or him or her. It's this person. So we've got to start to be analytical about what we mean by this particular person. So don't think of any other person. Just look at you now. Just focus on your own self. What makes up this person I call me? Of course, no. There's again, look into scientific things. You got carbon, nitrogen, and all these things, right? But they are just the basic components. You are there already. You know, make up the carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and sulfur, and whatever. Right? You are there already. Now, what exists now as I myself? What do I have within me? Right? I have within me this human body. Right? And I have within me that thing which we call the mind. Now, I'm speaking of mind as something, what do you call that? Something which you can really perceive. But in the Buddhist teaching, it's something more than that. Okay? Now, you look at it, this present body, we have that body and that mind which is capable of making things for us. So what do we have in this body? Rather than your carbon, nitrogen, and all this, rather than the head, neck, and shoulders, and arms, and bones, and phlegm, and the 32 things which the Buddha stated in the scripture, you have got basic things, 6 of them, right? 5 physical ones. The eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and your whole body, the other things which are not covered by this, as well as that brain, which, you know, you can say also the thing which allows the mind to work. If you have a physical body, and if you don't have this working mind, then you will be a dead person. And if you've got this physical body, and if your mind just works partially, then you will be a person in coma. No, doctor. So, anyway, without a mind, without the process of working of the mind, the body is dead. So, don't worry about the dead body. Right? If you're dead, you can't do anything. But while you're living, then you've got to see how does that body function. You've got to eat and all these things, of course. Now, that's the life-giving things. You've got to stay healthy. Of course, that's important to keep the body going. But at the same time, we got to know the mind. But most of us are very careful with the body. We eat a lot of supplements, vitamins, and all these things, this modern day thing, very trendy. And somebody told me, if I follow one of my friend's advice, I should be on 16 pills today, like krill oil, the glucosamine, and all those things. Right? But anyway, that's besides the point. But we keep the body going, and we are expert in keeping the body going. If you're sick, we can see a doctor. If you're not healthy, we do something to it. If you don't do something to it, you start to see, why am I growing fat? Why am I tired so easily? We have all these sort of things. We are very well aware of it. But unfortunately for most of us, unless you are a good Buddhist who practice, you're not worried about your mind. So the body, the Buddha tried to put a lot of importance on this mind. Because he knows that this healthy mind gives us healthy intention. And when you have got this healthy intention, you tend to exist or coexist with other beings and your environment in a more harmonious way. Right? And if you look at the teachings of the Buddha, it's all about harmony. You know, we talk about people being enlightened and all these things. It's the end of it. Right? But you've got to exist in harmony with your friends, people around you. And if you have doubts about it, think, what are these five precepts for? Right? Every Buddhist knows the five precepts. Right? Okay, just think of the five precepts in your mind. If you don't know it, then go and read some books. Well, ask some of your senior members here about it. Yeah? I mean, the precept of not killing. Don't kill the other human beings. Try not to kill the others as well. Right? I mean, it's not for you to go to heaven by not killing. When you don't kill, you have a peace of mind, and you get the other person have got a chance to live. Don't steal. Again, if you steal somebody's things, they're going to be at a loss. Right? So we are trying to produce this sort of things now, this sort of goodwill. The third one is don't commit adultery. Don't go and run away with people's husband or wife, right? Or boyfriends or girlfriends. So don't go there and grab them and run away. That's good relationship. Living in harmony again. Don't tell lies. No, that's very important. And from these no-telling lies, we say don't gossip. Don't use harsh words and all these other things to do with the speech. And that promotes harmony within the community. And of course, finally, we say don't get yourself... don't numb your mind with intoxicants, right? Alcohol or ice or whatever, because those sort of things will make you break the first four precepts. So these are the sort of things, basically, very basic thing. Now, can you imagine a society where everybody, a community, where everybody practice these five precepts? It'd be quite peaceful, wouldn't it? You can walk out of your house without locking your doors. You can go, you can have a very good, stable relationship without worrying other people to come and take away your partner. You can be sure that think people are truthful to you and so on. So the Buddha knows that. And the Buddha promotes that sort of things. That's for a harmonious community. And in order to get a harmonious community, what do we do? We've got to prepare ourselves for it. And we can say, make it a rule, make it law. We got a few thousand laws. Any lawyers here? You know the law books in Australia? It's about 10 or 15 bookcases, right? Thick volumes. Very nice, very impressive. But how many people break the law every day? And even those people who know the law will break the law. Right? So, it's because these people are not convinced or do not really take the trouble to train the mind according to the law. So the law is useless. It's a deterrent which does not work. Or sometimes a deterrent which works to enrich the coffers of the lawyers. It's only when people are convinced fully about wanting to live in harmony in society that we can live peacefully. We don't have to worry about laws, rules, or regulations anymore. Now, you look at the five precepts. they look into the respect for others. You respect people's life, or in the end, you respect life. Don't talk about animals first. Just respect other people's right to live. Other people's right to live in the way you wish to live. So in other words, you know, extend the thing. Not only don't kill other people, but make sure that the other people are comfortable to exist as well, like you. Same thing with the second precept. Let other people have got the right to enjoy the property without somebody taking it away from them in a very crooked way. Right? So don't steal. Third one is the same thing. Let people enjoy the relationship without the relationship being being ruined by the third party. In the case of the speech, make sure that people are not harmed by all this falsehood and things like that. Right? So you see, when you respect for life, you have respect for proprietorship, you have respect for the relationship, you have respect for truth. Then what else do you want in a society? And when people start to do that, then we can go one step further. You talk about developing this loving kindness. A lot of people like, you know, loving kindness is a big thing in Buddhism. Metta, karuna, mudita. They tell me, everybody tells me that. But you can't really have that loving kindness coming up without really keeping the precepts and without really looking into your mind. Because for us to keep the precepts, we got to be very mindful of what's happening in the mind. Sometimes when you think of the fellow, oh, the fellow is rude to me, so I feel like bothering him. So if you allow your actions to follow your mind, you go back, sharpen a knife, and go there you are, take it. And that's what a lot of people do in Australia. Right? You hear that, and they go drive-by shooting and all these things. Right? Because they just got angry, got upset. Then they go home, take the gun, and go and shoot people. Right? Or you know, the murders, and people pushing people off the cliff, and so on. It's because they follow the mind. Same thing with stealing things, doing all those things. Think of the four or five precepts. It's because they follow the mind. And where does these crooked ideas come from? Or these ideas which make them do all these things? It's because the mind is not disciplined. The mind is not purified. So you can say the teachings of the Buddha is that only about three things: avoid evil, do good, and purify the mind. Now, you can avoid evil, you can do good, but if you don't purify your mind, you still go back to evil, you still do and don't do good. Right? So it's the way we start to purify the mind. And you can't purify the mind without understanding the mind. Right? And the Buddha spent nearly 45 years trying to explain these sort of things to other human beings. He didn't preach to the dogs, he didn't preach to the cat. Right? Once in a while you might hear that he went up to heaven to preach the Dharma to his mother or something like that, or his ex-mother. But mainly he talked to human beings, right? People like you, people like me. Because he thinks human beings can think. Now, you look at, again, some of the writings in the scripture, it's mentioned that only the human beings can purify the mind. Because the end of purification of mind is enlightenment. And only human beings can get enlightened. So, there you are. There's the teachings there. And how much are we aware of these teachings? Sometimes we, again, go back to the belief. We believe in this, believe in that in Buddhism. But we neglect the teachings. And it's very important, like your society and all this, to go back to the teachings. And the teaching is nothing more than understanding yourself. And you look at it in a way, it's our actions, most of our actions, if done in a very unskilled manner, will bring us into trouble. And that trouble, we call it dukkha, brings stress to us. Now, that's the first noble truth, dukkha. Simple, D-U-K-K-A. H-A. I don't know how it's written in Sanskrit. You got a funny way of writing. But it's still there, dukkha. The second one is the more important one. Right? It says, the cause of dukkha. A lot of people try to say origin of dukkha. When you say origin of dukkha, you go back to the chicken and the eggs. Right? Because there's no origin. What the Buddha says, cause of dukkha, you know why the Buddha didn't say the origin of it? Or some people might want to say, you know, because your previous life, the previous life before that, but you can't prove that. It's not scientific. But what it says, now, this person in you, you've got the capability of making a lot of dukkha. Right? How we act, how we react, determines what sort, whether we get dukkha or not. You look at this cup, and say, I like this cup. Then after that, in my mind, I just look at my notes and say, ah, the cup is very nice. Must ask Unipat to give me this cup. Emily says, no, we have only one cup left. I get upset. You Unipats are so stingy, you won't give me the cup. Dukkha. It's a very simple thing. Very, very simple. And then when we bow to the Buddha, your eyes there, the fella is not bowing right. I bow like that, that's a perfect way of bowing. Whereas the fella just bow this way. There you are, dukkha. But all the simple things brings into it. There are some very strong ones which you can see. Like, you know, sometimes you get angry, you say, oh, why should I get angry? When you get angry, you have dukkha. And you ask yourself, why do you get angry? The dukkha doubles. And then after that, so all these things keep on happening. And maybe, possibly, if you are honest with yourself, tomorrow you just get a small, thick writing pad and write down how many dukkhas you have in a day. Everything you see, you go to the restaurant or canteen, you call it, you buy the laksa. This is laksa, it's different from the one you say, dang, this laksa is made by Indonesians. Not so tasty. So, there you are. Dukkha. What do you go? You don't go in there to have laksa, whether it's to be made by people from Penang or from Kuala Lumpur. Right? You go there to satisfy your hunger. Right? But you forgot that. You get upset because the laksa doesn't suit my taste. Dukkha. Right? So, everywhere, dukkha. Right? You sit down, I say, okay, you sit down comfortably. Right? Everybody sits down very comfortably when they start meditation. And I can see after 2 minutes, starting to have dukkha in some people. After 5 minutes, dukkha in quite a number of people. Right? Unless they train. So this is the sort of things we don't know about this. We are not clear about the sort of things. So the Buddha make it very clear. Things like that. I see this cup, I like this cup. Now, you think that it's happiness, right? I like this cup, happiness. But it brings about my desire to want it. And if I can't get it, dukkha. So, the Buddha says almost everything in this world is dukkha. So, but he says, well, where does the dukkha come from? The cause of it, what makes it happen? You go back to that person. I wouldn't want to blame my dukkha on you. Right? Because according to one of the English writers, he says, an uncivilized people blame others for his faults. A civilized person blames himself. But the Buddhists blame neither. You don't blame others, you don't blame yourself. You just look at it, this is the way it is. This is the way I am responsible for it. So you look at it, okay. Do you know that you have dukkha or not? I have dukkha. Where does the dukkha come from? The mind and the body. The mind is there. It's a process of working. The body is there to receive signals and to send out signals. Right? You receive signals through your, what you call the sense bases. Right? You don't call it sense organs. It's bases. Because it's where everything starts from. You see something, you either like or dislike, or sometimes, you know, doesn't matter. The doesn't matter is all right. It won't cause you any problem. The problem with when it starts when you like or dislike something. Same thing with what you hear. No. Yeah. Actually, for a lot of people, what they hear is more, affects them a lot more than what they see. You hear something you like, Oh, Jim, you are a very good person. Oh, happy. Jim, you delivered a very bad talk today. Upset. So, these sort of things. Comes, it's like that. And same thing with what you smell, what you taste, and how your body feels. And sometimes it's, and most of the time it's the thought that's generated. What you see, it generates into thought. What you hear, it generates into thought. But sometimes you don't see or don't hear or nothing. Right? You sit down there, everything is so nice. All of a sudden, this thought's coming up and cause you dukkha. Right? You go and sit down, in the walk in the park, it's so beautiful, the birds are there, you know, the sound is so pleasant, there's no nasty people around, no cars, no smoke. You walk, all of a sudden, I left my bag in I left my wallet in my living room. I don't know whether my housemate will take my wallet away or not. There you are. Everything beautiful, but you're standing in dukkha already. So this mind's dukkha is actually the most important. That's why the Buddha stressed the importance of the mind. So the second noble truth which the Buddha talked about is this mind. Your own mind that makes all these things. You decide for yourself things you like, things you don't like. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, all you decide for yourself. But for many people who are not trained in the teachings of the Buddha, they have no control over it. They become slaves of their own mind, slaves of their own thinking. And all this, how do we think is what the sum total of our experiences in the past. For example, why don't I go to a certain restaurant? Because I eaten there 2 years ago and the food was horrible. The fried chicken was half cooked. Or the fried chicken is already dry. So when my friend asked me, let's go to this place, I said, no, the ayam goreng there is terrible. So I won't go now. Why? Because my reaction, and my memory, I think about it. And so, as we go on, our actions, our reactions, and all these things, very much depends on our past experiences. And for some people, they try to change, but some cannot change. If I don't like person of a certain color, certain hairstyle, that's it. I see them, I hate them. Yeah, that's where you get dukkha. And it's all because of that desire of ours. We like something, we don't like something. We like something, we don't like something. Like one day, every day you go through hundreds, thousands or millions of times like that. Why you like certain lecturers, why you don't like certain lecturers. So I don't have to talk very much about that, but know your mind. Right? The mind in action with your body. Right? So you ask me which comes first, the mind comes first or the body comes first, I can't tell you either. It's there already. Right? It works together. And that's why the Buddha didn't say which comes first, the mind or the body. It says it's already there. So these sort of things, it's ready for you to act and react. So when we have this mind and body, what happens next? We constantly receive signals from outside. Right? The eye signal, the ear signal, and all this. We call it the sight, the smell, the smell, the sound, the taste, the tactile feeling, and so on. And this is the thing. When you start to receive these signals, you are coming into contact with these things. So when you come into contact, the next thing which happens, which the mind goes into, will be that sensation you have. When you look at certain things, there's an impact. And that's what we call sensation. When I look at you, I know these people, our doctor there, I know him from ages ago. So I can recognize him even as I see him far away, right? So let's say when I set sight on it, automatically, very quickly it happens. Oh, that's Mingda. And supposing he puts on a wig, he puts on the dark glasses and changes appearance, I must say, is that him or not? So that's why, right? So it gives us that sensation. And that sensation, next thing is to whether you have received this. Now, what happens after that? The mind, again, manifests itself into a pleasant or unpleasant sensation. I mean, when I see members of the Unibuds, I'm always very happy. Because I know you guys are learning Dharma and I'm teaching Dharma. So that has something in common, right? You've got that beautiful feeling coming up. I say, Unibuds fellows. So when Emily rang me the other day and said, very short notice, I don't mind. So it's like that, because of that good will, good sensation. But supposing I've got some bad experience with you guys before. Some of you have been very rude, some of you tell me off and all these things. Next time, Unibuds call me, I'm not going. So this is the way it is, right? Now, when you see the thing, when you hear the voices, when you hear, smell something, right? Sometimes, it's not that something which is pleasant to others is pleasant to you. Right? Sometimes, I get this, perfumes. Some people will say this perfume costs $600 for that little vial. I say, you're stupid. How are you buy that expensive perfume for? Very nice. I say, it smells worse than that thing in the toilet. Because I don't like it, that's why. So again, it gives me that reaction. Right? So it's the value comes within you. Now, to me, a piece of steak, beautiful. I love it because I'm not a vegetarian. I love beef. But then my friend, he looks at it and says, that sort of thing is terrible. Right? So it's the way, we give into our likes and dislikes. So it's after that pleasantness and unpleasantness of feeling, then these likes and dislikes come in. And together with the likes and dislikes, now how we have dislikes and dislikes, it's from our previous experiences. Right? Previous experiences meaning that, you might have got a bad experience with it, when I strike a match and I try to put it on your body, what do? You don't say, come and burn me. You just run away from it. So it's that. Because in the past, you know that this fire burns you. So it's the same thing with everything we do. When we get bad experiences before, or if we get our information, we fed information before. It's just like, a lot of things. When people eat certain things and they get diarrhea, especially in Malaysia, I know a lot of people don't drink milk. Oh no, this case, not with you guys, but the older generation. This one of my friends believed that drinking tap water will cause diarrhea. And sure enough, every time you give the fellow tap water, he gets diarrhea. So those days when I was not so good a Buddhist, I used to do nasty things, you see. So one day he came to my house, she came to my house, then he said, can I have some water? I said, okay, I'll go and boil the water for you, I cool down the water, I bring to you. But I went to the tap, and he gave me the water. So 2 days later, I met her again, I said, do you get diarrhea or not? He said, no, why? I said, daddy, I gave you unboiled water, why didn't you get diarrhea? Okay, it's just an idea we get. Right? These sort of things, those psychologists, doctors, and psychiatrists can tell you these sort of things is part and parcel of our way of thinking. And when you get these sort of ideas, it goes into your memory. And when the time is right, it just comes up. So when it comes up, that becomes the perception. I look at this, it's a cup or it's a mug. And why do I know it's a cup or a mug? Because ever since I was a kid, right? I was told, maybe when I was a very young kid, I was told a mug in Malay, or I was told a mug in Chinese. So I know, they call it kole in Malay. You call it, I don't know why you call it mug in Chinese, I forgot already. So anyway, that is the thing, I know it. Right? So when you put that, there's a mug. And what's inside there? Tea. I recognize as tea because I know this color and all these things. So it's the memory it tells me. You identify the thing. When you identify the thing, then it's a different thing. If this tea comes from Taiwan, I know this is the Highland tea in Taiwan. Right? Or this tea is the what do you call it? The Sui Xin. I know it's Sui Xin. Right? So already because I've got experience of tasting them. So then from there, I start to think it's good or bad. And then after that, right, when I start to think it's good or bad, or nice or not nice, this is the first part of the volition. And the second part of volition is the moment I think it's nice or not nice, then I know it's meant for drinking. Right? And I start to want to drink it, even though I'm not thirsty. I say, okay, good. Or maybe the tea was offered to me by Unibar, so I must drink it, right? As to be polite. And so I sip the tea. So when I sip the tea again, it starts the whole round again. There's this taste sensation. The tea is very nice. Oh, yeah, very nice. I tell people very nice. The tea is not nice, and I won't say it's not nice, but I pull my break. It's very rude to say it's not nice. So if I want to be a very un-Buddhistic, I say, it's very nice still. So this is the way it is. This volition. And that's how I act and react. And when I say it's very nice, when it's not nice, I was hoping that you would like me. Oh, Jim is a very polite person. He always appreciates the tea we give him. All these things will come out, right? And so my value in you comes out. So the link gets stronger. Right? It's, then in the case next time you give me tea, you invite me for tea some more. You invite me for a talk. So these are the sort of things. You know? It goes on and on and on. Right? And this is the way we act and react. And if we do not know how to react properly, then we're going to trouble. Firstly, if I react not properly, I take the tea and I don't, to me, if I feel that this tea should be very, very good, right? Then I take the tea and say, it's not up to my standard. So if I do it stupidly, I take the tea and throw away, and you guys see me throwing the tea away, he says, oh, the fellow wasted our tea. Right? And my standard goes down. Dukkha. But first thing is, before my standard goes down and get a dukkha, I already got a dukkha of not liking it. After all, tea is tea. Right? If you give me poison, then it's a different story. But the tea is for me to quench my thirst. Now, after talking for 15, 20 minutes, I get thirsty, don't I? So you guys are considering giving me the tea. So I should be grateful to it. Now, when I start to have this grateful feeling, which is a very important part of the Buddhist teaching, then what happens? Within me, I already started that goodwill. Right? I say, thank you for giving me this tea. Right? Of course, you know, I can extend this by praying to Buddha. Buddha, you know, they give me good tea, let them be happy, let them be well. But that's besides the point. But I'm grateful. And the gratitude, feeling of gratitude, it's a very, very important part of the Buddhist teachings. Even though the tea may not be up to my standard, but because of your kindness, I receive your kindness, I feel grateful to you, I thank you, therefore we are exchanging good feelings. And that's how you have a good link with other people in your community. So this way it goes on and on for many, many different things. It's not only just one or two things. But if you can incorporate this sort of idea in your whole life. And so, therefore, we've got to be very careful of these four things in our mind. The sensation, we can't stop it. But after the sensation, see what happens. You start to have this, develop this feeling of liking or disliking, just know it. And try to avoid this disliking. That's where you can cut off a link. Don't say, I dislike it, therefore I must react. It bring out, try to bring out the so-called the good part in you. But if you read if you go through the Buddhist teachings of the Four Noble Truths, in bringing out the right effort, there are four things you've got to do. Right? It means, number, it looks into the person. Every human being is like that. We've got some of the skillful and the wholesome part in us. We've got unskillful and unwholesome parts in us. The Buddha mentioned in the teaching of developing right efforts, when you have got the unwholesomeness in you, or say, when you've got the wholesomeness in you, make sure that you make your wholesomeness more. Develop it to make it better. If there are wholesomeness which you still haven't got yet, try to bring it up. Right? Try to give birth to it within you. You see some people who have got something wholesome which you haven't got, try to follow them and bring that up. Whatever wholesomeness you have in you, and most of you have it, to be kind, to be pleasant and all, you just bring it up as well. The unwholesomeness, you try to look at it this way. Whatever wholesomeness you have, try to reduce it and get rid of it. If it's prone to getting angry, prone to getting upset with things, okay, look at it and then slowly reduce it. And for whatever unwholesomeness which you haven't got, don't go and copy. Don't go and pick it up. If, for example, like I remember in our society here, years ago when I first came to Australia, there were very, very few examples of road rage. The native Australians are not good at getting upset with the people in the roads. I used to travel from Cronulla down to the city, and you can see everybody follows the same single lane. Right? Until the city, they don't cut in and out like that. And you seldom see people yelling and putting the fist out and calling people's mother something else. Right? So, that one. But now, because they already absorbed this unwholesomeness from elsewhere. Right? So everybody having rage and all these things. So this is the way. For us, we see, if I don't have this unwholesomeness, if I won't want to pick it up. I got this unwholesomeness that I have, slowly I get rid of it. But to do it requires a lot of effort as well. That's why they say, you know, develop the right effort. It's effort to get rid of it. Effort to bring up the good points. And there's only one way to do it, through understanding your own self. You can put all the laws in this world and say, you must develop right effort. We develop the right effort in the wrong way. But if we start to be aware of your own thinkings, then it's much easier for you to develop the right effort. And one of the ways to do it is to develop, again, another part of the Eightfold Path, right mindfulness. Mindfulness is to know what your mind is doing at any particular moment. You're starting to get angry, you know that I'm getting angry. And then once you know that you're starting angry, if you train yourself to purify the mind, you take the anger away and go back to do what you are doing. And that's very simple. That's what we call right mindfulness. I mean, nobody wants to get angry just to go to the place and say, I want to get angry. Like, you go to the supermarket and say, I want to get angry or not? No. But when you start to wait in the checkout, this guy, you know, got this credit card. Right? Just follow me, and that's how I get angry sometimes. Right? I got this credit card. One credit card, no, won't work. Another one won't work. Another one won't work. And yeah, there the queue is building up. Everybody starts to get angry. Right? And that's why, because we react to things. Right? And if you can see that you're getting angry in the very beginning, stand behind him. Okay, you got no money in the credit card. Too bad. I got to wait for you. Too bad. When you have that sort of idea, then you don't get angry. And when you don't get angry, you don't really put your anger to other people. Usually, I've seen one case when the fellow was angry at somebody in the queue. Then when he comes to the turn into the to pay the money with the checkout chick made something wrong. The girl who worked in the checkout there did some mistake or a bit slow. He starts getting very angry, yell at her. So, then you're angry at something else and you vent your anger at something else. And when you're venting your anger, what happens? Before you can make the other person miserable, you are miserable already. So this is the way you look at it. So, when you do look at it, this is the right mindfulness part. I'm starting to get upset. And when you're starting to get upset, what do you do? So train ourselves to let go of it. So when you look at it, on one hand, we always creep and get attached to things. On the other hand, the Buddha says, learn how to let go. Letting go at the right time actually saves a lot of problems within yourself and others. So, right mindfulness. Now, in order for you to get right mindfulness, you don't simply say, I want to be mindful. A lot of people tell me, you know, Buddha says right mindfulness, I want to be mindful. It's not that, not so simple either. All of us are mindful. We are mindful about, when you want to cross the road, you are mindful about the cars coming and going. Right? If you are not careful, you either land in heaven, hell, or hospital. So, that one. Then you see, you see a cliff in front of you, do you walk straight into the cliff? No. Just stop yourself. If you are not mindful, you won't survive until this very moment to come and listen to this talk, isn't it? So we are mindful in that way. But we are not mindful about how our unruly mind works. Right? Sometimes we are not mindful of how we straight away you go there, straight away you go here, getting upset, getting angry, getting jealous, getting scared, and all these things, all the emotional things. We do not even know how these emotions arise in us. Well, there's a savior in you, right? Buddha. He won't take away all your misery, because the Buddha never promised to save you of your misery. He says he teaches you to save your own self. Right? He teaches you not to save so much, but to liberate yourself from all this dukkha. So we understand how he teaches. Look in your mind. And how do you look in your mind? In the modern days, we say meditation. That's why we place a lot of importance on meditation. But this meditation involves other things as well. A very important part in meditation is to be able to develop this stability of the mind. If the mind is not stable, it still keeps on going. You can sit down there, your mind is not stable. You guys have the experience before, or even now. You sit down, I want to concentrate on my breathing, here or here. But what happens? What am I going to have for lunch tomorrow? Am I going to be late for lecture tomorrow? Tomorrow I got to go for the nasty accountancy lecture. It goes. So we got to develop this stable mind. And to develop this stable mind, we have got to be mindful. Right? Start with the mindfulness of your breathing. Now, it goes, that's why you go, which comes first? That should be a balance of two. As you go on, start to be mindful of the breathing, the movements, it goes back, bring it back, and then develop slowly. You get a stability. And the stability is what we call concentration. When you have got the stability of mind through concentration, it's much easier for you to be aware of what's happening. So, if you go through this mindfulness meditation, it tells you that. Just have a stable mind. Develop a concentration. Be aware of these distractions first. When you sit down there, there will be 101 distractions for you. A lot of people like to meditate with open eyes. I say you added another 50% of your distraction. So, when you close your mind, you go to a quieter place where there's no noise. When you sit comfortably, when your body doesn't have all these feelings, you don't eat anything, and you don't sit next to a person who uses very strong antiperspirant. No perfume to distract you. You're closing a lot of sense doors. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? And what you got to be careful about is your thoughts, and sometimes the occasional sound that comes in. So that you can know these are the distractions. And when I said before, the Buddha always teaches how to let go. Right? And letting go, you find, is a very, very important part of Buddhism. In fact, it's nearly all of Buddhism. Because letting go is the opposite of attachment. It's through this attachment, through our senses, the eyes, the things of the eyes, things of the ears and all this, that we get into a lot of dukkha. So you get this, when you get a signal, you're able to know this signal is there. And you're able to let go of the signal, then naturally you are dealing with the first part of the problem. So when your mind is stable and then you start to develop this mindfulness becomes sharper and sharper, what happens is you'll be able to be aware of what's happening in the mind. Sit down there, you don't smell things, it's all right, but that unruly brain of yours gets all these messages coming in. You sit down there, you want me to tell a whole story? Sit down there and think of a wallet, money, $15, and my friend owes me $15, and now he's now somewhere in Singapore or in Penang. I get really upset. I must go. The next time I go back, I must get the money from him. Okay, all my consideration gone, right? Because I was not aware. But if I'm aware of it, the thought comes up and say, okay, money or wallet. I say, thought, thinking, wallet. Then let go of the wallet and come back to my breathing. Then I got no problems with the other thoughts. It's a very simple exercise, actually. And it sums out all of Buddhism as well. It's very simple. But it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of energy to train. Why effort? Why energy? Because we have untrained ourselves that sort of way. We are let go, you know, of our things. We have been subjected to all the emotional things in our mind. And sometimes in the society, we tell emotions is good. So we keep on being a slave to our emotions, slave to our thinking, and so on. But the moment you start to get to be more understanding of it, and then you can start doing something. So the training in our meditation is to understand things, how it happens, and to let go of it as we go. And when we start to do that, what happens is you start to understand yourself a lot better. You don't understand other people. The worst thing is, you know, sometimes people come to meditate and bring along his girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife and say, I want to understand him better. You understand yourself very well, then you understand others very well. You understand how you get angry, you understand how other people get angry. That's why in the teachings, Buddha says internally and externally. We understand ourselves first, then understand others. Do not change the sequences. Don't go and say, you want to understand others, then you understand yourself. You can never do that. So as we develop the understanding of ourselves, how we function, how we act, how we react, then you become very clear about your actions and reactions. And when we clear about actions and reactions, we have a choice to avoid those actions which are unwholesome or which cause harm to other people. And we have got the opportunity of trying to develop actions which are wholesome and which are beneficial to others and to yourself. So far, most of the time I've mentioned about these very negative things, right? Your anger, your fears, worries, disappointments, you know, your action, reaction. This is in a very negative way. But there are a lot of positive things which all of us are capable of doing. Right? Number one, we are capable of being loving. Right? What we call metta. But the way we project our love is very much through sort of a very human way. Right? In a way that when we love somebody or something, that strong desire is there. And we want to hold on, cling on to the person. Right? Think you love your parents, you love your brothers and sisters, you love your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever. Right? I mean, it's all natural that we have this love. But unfortunately for most of us, we put a value to this love and we use this love as a bondage. I link onto you, therefore you must listen to me. I give you 5 points, 5 units of love, I want 6 units back from you. So, these are the things. This is the way we do. The Buddha put it in a very different way. He says, try to have this love without wanting it back. Just have these good feelings. So there's a training on that. That's what we call the loving kindness thing. But unfortunately, people put loving kindness before everything else, right? Which is almost impossible to do. You got to start to develop your own understanding of the mind first, and try to keep the precepts first, right? To help develop this respect for life, respect for proprietorship, respect for relationship, respect for truth first, right? The 4 precepts. Before we can really bring out all these good feelings. So as you go in your practice, if you practice it well enough, you find that will be developed naturally. You find that if you don't get angry for a person in the first place, we are actually showing our love for the person. True or not? Because when you get angry at the person, you're actually showing your hate. And if you take away the hate, then that love will replace it. So, slowly as we go. And the other one the Buddha encourages is the way that the feeling of compassion we have. Right? Now, when you talk about this love for others, loving kindness as we put it, right, which is unconditioned love, the compassion will also naturally arise. People will, you will see a person in a miserable situation. If you look at them and you can relate to that sort of misery, you understand it. Right, supposing you see a person being run down by a car and then broke a leg or something and then broke his leg bones. If you have got any compassion, you know, that person is really in a state of suffering. If I were to be in this situation, I'll suffer this way. And not only that, thinking of that is one thing. But when you start to have that, if you have got a good feelings coming up, right, when you relate to a person, other people well enough, then you say, okay, what can I do to help? Right? And we can't really say, and the rule book say like this, you must do that. You come, if you have got a very good mind in you, you naturally will know how to react, right, and help, and make sure that the pain is being reduced or whatever. Now the third thing is more important is this, what we call mudita. People talk about this joy and all this. It's something like that, but it's the appreciation of things. We know how to love, we know how to be compassionate. But when somebody is successful and all these things, what do you think? If you're happy like they are, or are you jealous and so on? When somebody does something really well, do you really give them the indication that you're pleased with it? When you do something else, of course you give the indication to yourself. I'm very pleased, I'm really good. See that? But when somebody else does it well, how do you react? So it's better training. When somebody does very well, if they do it better than you, just feel happy for them as well. Now, if you follow these three, and there's a fourth one I wouldn't go into equanimity, because naturally when you have all these three done, the fourth one will come up. Right? That's equanimity. So as you go on, you find that through your not doing these evil things, and through your bringing all the good qualities in you, what sort of person will you be? A lot of cynics will tell me, everybody will step over me. Oh, if I don't worry about things and all these things. It's not that you don't worry. You are concerned. That's all. When people are sick, you don't simply say, oh, it's your bad karma, you can fall sick. I don't care. No, don't have that funny Buddhist belief. I mean, it's not that the Buddhist is funny, but that particular belief is a very funny belief. Don't think that, oh, you're bad karma. You see somebody get knocked by a car, oh, you're bad karma. Last previous life, you must have driven a car and then knocked somebody down. Therefore, this life, somebody knocks you. So, this knot. When you see something like that, try to help. Develop good feelings. When you start to develop these good feelings, the first person to benefit won't be them, you know. It's yourself. If you know you have done good things before in your life, maybe you put in $5 in a donation box or something. How do you feel after you do that? I know some of you say, I shouldn't have given $5. But if you have given $5 and be happy about it, it stays with you. And after a while, when you think, oh, 2 years ago I put $5 in a donation box and feel happy about it, who is the beneficiary? Nobody has seen it, but you know what you have done. So that's the way we train ourselves, to be kind, to be nice, and so on. We don't try not to do it because some people tell you, oh, you do this good deed, you get 5 marks. You do another good deed, you get a 10 marks. Right? As if somebody is having a card, writing down all these things. So when you die, the next life, you know, you get to have a good rebirth, and so on. That's a popular belief. But just think, when you have done something good, it stays with you in your memory. Right? It will encourage you to do further good things. And if you're going to subscribe yourself to those funny thinking of the cynics to say that if I'm too good a person, people will bully me. It's up to them. Right? Because if these are people, when they do something good, people are suspicious of it. But if you start to be really good and genuine with it, people might take advantage of you. But so what? I've known in some cases, it's a practical, very... something which taught me a lesson. We do some volunteer work sometimes, right? And this guy came and see me one day and grumbled to me. He says, oh, the guy tried to make use of me. So all of a sudden, my Buddhist wisdom comes out. Not it comes out, not, doesn't come out very often, but it came out again. I said, you are a volunteer, aren't you? He said, yes. And I said, you put here, make use of me, isn't it? So he make use of you, so what's wrong with it? You see, these sort of things. So we try to be nice, and people make use of you, doesn't matter. As long as they make use of you not to do anything illegal or anything which are harmful. If they think you're a nice person, therefore, I want to cause some harm to the fella, you go and do it for me. That's not right. And of course, I got one of my people whom I know, and said, oh, you're a nice person. I said, yes, I'm trying to be nice. He says, you can make me very happy by joining my religion. I said, go to hell. So, now look at it. I always have this saying, and please remember this, Buddhists are dumb, but not stupid. So we know what's happening. Yeah. You can push me around, but don't push me over the point. So it's that way. We've got to have our own values to stand upon. A lot of people tell me, don't pray to that idol there. I say, what's wrong with it? It's my religion. I pray to it. So I'm not going to succumb to all these ideas just because you want me to be like that. We've got these values which we keep, and the values which we keep is two guides there. Harm and benefits. Don't do anything which harm others and yourself. And do everything you want to benefit others and yourself. So in other words, you look into this, go back to this linkage again. That's the best guide you can have. Do something. Try not to harm others. Do something. Try to benefit others. Of course, there's something in between, things which are beneficial to you but harming others. Think that many, many times and see whether you should do it or not. So, this is the way, but you cannot do it until you understand yourself, until you understand your actions, where does it come from, whether you can generate any good action and curb any bad action. So this is a very simple thing. Go back to the teachings of Buddha again. Avoid evil, do good, and purify the mind. So you purify your mind, you start to be able to avoid evil, you purify the mind, you're able to do good. Right? The avoiding evil will be looking into our precepts. When you start to be mindful of things, then the precepts will not be a rule anymore. Right? Because I hate people to come and tell me these precepts being rules. They say, oh, first precept not to kill, but how much can I go before I call it killing? Right? Do I just break his leg and don't take away his life? Is it killing or not? So we have all these sort of ideas coming in. Right? Stealing, the same thing. What do you call stealing? Take a thing like that. Now, supposing if I were to take a little bit at a time, is it stealing or not? You know, it's rule. When you have rules, you try to break the rules. Right? Or if you keep the rules too strongly within you, the rules will break you. So this is the way it is. When you are mindful of things, the precepts no longer becomes rule. You understand it. You know why you do it. And it becomes a daily thing. It becomes a natural thing for you. You want to tell lies? I'm going to lie. So you got two choices. Tell the lies or don't tell the lies. And if you are aware of it, chances of you telling the lies is not there. So train yourself like that. And we start to, once you do that, and you find that that person whom others call you and you call yourself will be a better person. And with better person, we got better relationship with others. And that's what we call this linkage. Does this answer your question, Emily?
I hope it does what everyone else do.
Okay, any questions?
Jim, I have a question for you, huh?
Yeah.
You know, Darwin's theory of evolution, it's not mentioned in the Buddha's canon that we come from monkeys and all that, but then how can you say that Darwin and evolution and Buddha is
when you look at the basis of evolution, what do you mean by evolution? That's Darwin. What is Darwin based on? Yeah, that is based on changes. Evolution is change. Yeah, that's why. That's why it's the same thing. The Buddha talked about changes. Right? Nothing stays forever. And actually, we go one step further than that to say that not only the physical self change, not only the species change, not only the world changes, but it's also the mind of that particular person. Yeah, we change all the time.
You never use evolution. The word evolution is canon, right? You never have
That's why the Buddhist... No, I'm saying that the Buddhist can agree with evolution, like, as a scientific thing.
Yeah, common elements.
Yeah, because evolution mentions a lot of change. Right? You look at evolution, it's all about changes. Why from a monocell animal, it becomes, you know, multi-cell animal and the plants and all these things, and come to become a very complex animal like the mammals. Right? So it's that sort of change over a long period. But the Buddha, with the same principle, the Buddha talked about this person being me and how I change. Right? You look at me, maybe you look at me 2 years ago, I'm the same. But actually, I'm a different person. Every moment, I'm a different person. Right? If you look at from a scientific point of view, it's a change. I evolve as well. 2 years ago, I've got a certain amount of knowledge. But 2 years hence, I got more knowledge. Right? So my mind evolved, my body evolved. But this evolution, Darwin was right. It doesn't mean that you get better and better all the time. Right? Towards the end there will be an extinction of the species. I'll be extinct as well.
But in original scriptures, did he mention how the species evolved?
You see, Darwin is a scientist. Science talk about physical things. The Buddha, I'm not saying the Buddha is talking about science. The Buddha's method is very scientific. It talks about this change, and science is about change. It talks about pure logic. I'm not talking about the logic. I'm talking about this logic rather than I am you and all these things, right? All this mere logic. Right? So if you go deeply into the Buddhist teachings, it's all about this sort of things. That's why it makes us think a lot better. The clarity of thinking is there. Like it's simple. You know, people say, okay, everything must be created. Therefore, God created it. And then goes back to there. And then my argument as a Buddhist is, who creates God then? Then somebody will tell me, oh, God is self-created. I say, okay, assuming that God is self-created, everything else can be self-created, can't they? See, you know, these are the sort of logic we have. And that Buddhist logic holds water.
Is that similar to this logic? Buddhist logic? Is it similar to
mathematics? Yes, that's right. But unfortunately for most of us, we see logic through our, what the Buddha called, ignorant mind. Right? Even until now, a lot of scientists ask. That's why science is something which is changing as well, which is a very good thing because they keep on probing. Whereas for us, we go into the teachings and start to understand things. When you understand things, things are much clearer and you don't have to really go and employ these sort of things. But if you need to employ, the logic is there for you to employ them. But of course, no, I'm up to this stage. If I go further, I don't know how long I've got to go further. Because if you look at the Buddha's teaching, it's all about these logical things. And his mind is a lot much more better developed than any of us around here. And that's why we consider him to be a great person.
I have a question about what you mentioned earlier regarding letting others use you. I was hoping if you could elaborate a bit more for cases where say you take for example university assignments, group university assignments, for example. Apparently everyone's meant to do equal amounts of work, and if I like applying this principle, then it's kind of okay if I do it, like one person does everything and then the other two is using.
Mm-hmm.
So would you be able to elaborate a bit more in
regards to that? I can't give you a specific thing, but now, supposing I do all the hard work and you come and try to nibble on my work, I can tell you go away.
Yeah.
Right? Or I can tell you, okay, and this is a piece for you to nibble. I've got a choice. And so it's a very personal thing. Supposing is if you're in love with somebody, right? And then you're under the same course, you know, somebody in your class, and they say, can I share with you a little bit? I'm quite sure you give everything to the person. Right now, I'm not giving you an answer, but you think about it. Right? So, what's the difference with somebody whom you like and somebody whom you think is starting to come and steal my assignment? Right? Now, you can give, you don't have to give. Right? If you feel generous, you give. You don't feel generous, you don't give. Right? Buddha doesn't give you a definite answer on that. Right? But as you progress in your practice, you will be able to make up your mind. And there are very often, you know, especially, you know, you walk down to town, in a railway station, somebody says, can you spare me $5 for a pie or something like that? I'm hungry or whatever. No. A lot of people say, why should I give? A lot of people say, I give. Who is right? The person who is thinking at, whatever is thinking at the moment is right. But if you feel that you want to give $5 and you feel generous and good about giving, just give. Right? If you don't feel like giving, don't give. A lot of people don't give and they start to think, oh, that fella, look at him, he must be taking the money to go and buy drugs and blah, 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 all these ideas. You don't give and still carry the burden. Right? And this fella give and then feel happy about it, I've given my money and walk away. He doesn't carry the burden. But unfortunately, most of us, we give after giving. Maybe I shouldn't give at all. You give and carry the burden. So there are choices for us. Right? Buddhism is all about choices. And you understand it, you make the choice at the moment, you know. And you, when you start to experience it down the track, then you say, okay, next time I want to give or next time I want to give. Nothing worse than one case. This guy gave those days $2. It's not $5. Give it $2. And after that, he saw the fellow going to into the cigarette place, go and buy a packet of cigarettes. Thank you, man. Jim, I just give $2 and then the fellow went and buy cigarettes, get upset. I say, why do you give in the first place? He said, I feel generous. I say, if you feel generous, you give, then you shouldn't be thinking about it. So that's what the Buddha talked about, you know, this, again, which I didn't elaborate on this generosity. If you give, you give. Now, in the temple, usually you find there's a box there. Give the money. Give. A lot of people give the money. May I pass my exams. You do that. You are looking at the things in the wrong way. Right? What should you do to pass exams? Is it spending money or is it studying harder? So if you get your thinking right, your priority right, then you give the money because you want to help the temple, or you want to help whatever, Buddhism, right? But you want to pass the exams, don't give money to pass the exams. I got to tell you, I think some of you senior guys have heard my story before. No, there's a temple in Penang, Sri Lanka. Anybody from Penang? Okay. In Kampar Road, there's a temple called Mahindrama Temple. You've been there before? Yeah. And there's a nice Bodhi tree there. So 50 years ago, I was told, if you pray, go there and very religiously pray to the Bodhi tree. That's what, this is our custom, right? Yeah, and then after you walk a few rounds, your wish will be granted, especially exams. But then the thing is, if you ask for a wish, you must tie a stone on the tree. Then after that, you know, when you pass, if you happen to pass your exams, then you bring a bottle of milk and pour on the roots. So okay, anyway, I did that, and I passed the exam very well, and then got a bottle of milk and pour in. So one year, the Bodhi tree nearly died. because they get a crop of very, very good results in the HSC to many, many schools, right? And all the Buddhist kids, male and female, they went to pray, and then they passed the exams, and then they brought bottles of milk at the same day and pour in. And for all of you who knows about plant biology, right? Milk is acidic, and if you pour too much milk, it starts to turn sour, and it nearly killed the tree. So after that, there's a big sign there: please do not put milk on the tree. So I mean, we are doing a lot of times we do things for a different reason. When you donate to a temple, you donate it because for the cause of, for the help of the temple. You give money to the monk because you want to support the monk. Right? Don't go and pretend yourself that you're giving your money and then you pass your exams. This might be by coincidence you pass your exams because you work hard. Now, my very famous challenge to people is, you know, if prayers and gods and all these things work, right, enroll yourself into a course which you never know. Like all of you go and enroll in a Greek course in Greek language, right? And then don't go and study. Don't go to attend lectures, nothing. Right? Don't even read a Greek book. Go and pray to the Buddha, go and pray to Jesus Christ every day and see whether you pass the exams or not. So these are the sort of things you look at. It's not that we shouldn't donate to temples and all this. It's just that don't donate it for a different cause. Okay, any other questions?
Okay, I have one more. Briefly, how do you compare Buddhist wisdom with Confucian wisdom or Aristotle's wisdom or the wisdom of a normal person who is just live through ages? How do you compare?
I think they got no...
How do they differ?
We don't compare or differ because I think the Buddha does not agree or disagree. It's just the way people think. And we, you see, in a way, we, unless it becomes too ridiculous, the Buddha said nothing about it. During his time,
wisdom, right?
We don't know what wisdom they have. That's why when you want to comment on certain things, you know, the higher learnings of the East, the Muslims and all these things, I won't know. But as far as you go into the comparison about Confucianism, I mean, it's been there in China for nearly 2,000 years. You find that it's very compatible.
Do you think the Buddhist wisdom is very compatible?
That's why Buddhism went very well with Confucianism until...
But how do they differ? They are two different schools of...
Yeah, but people. We don't... You see, the thing is, a monk told me a long time ago, he says, if you look at the differences, you get no end of differences. You fight, you quarrel. If you look at similarities, everything seems to be perfect. So this is the way we look at things.
Yeah, but how do you define Buddha's wisdom? Explain it.
The wisdom cannot be defined.
Right?
It's just, when you talk about Buddha's wisdom, it's understanding.
Of what?
Of nature, of your own self. When you understand your own self, then you understand the world.
That's what Buddhist wisdom is about.
Yeah, that's the Buddha's wisdom. Right? And we look in Confucius' wisdom, there are 8 things which you got to go. Right? From the ruling the become the great man to rule the world and so on, it comes down. Yeah, it goes down to that person. Then you got to have the stability of the mind. You got to be understand things, investigate into things, and all this the 4 which to do with the person to what you call that to improve the person. It comes in perfect harmony with Buddhism. You got no problem with that. If you look at it, then Buddha asks you to investigate things. Observe things. Observe your mind. Investigate the mind. Right? So it goes very well with it. And then the rest, well, it's all man-made ones. Right? So we don't worry about the man-made ones. You look in the principle behind it. Right? And in a way, you know, the thing is, we work also very well with some aspect of the Hindu religion. We work very well with some aspects of the Muslim religion. There are a lot of you know, similarities there. But we won't say that Buddhism equals Hinduism or Buddhism equals Islam. There's no such thing. Buddhism is still Buddhism. Right? The Buddhist teaching is still Buddhist teaching. And you look at it within Buddhism itself, who is right? Now, we are not going to talk about that, right or wrong. When you talk about right or wrong, you can talk until the cow come home and nobody will get an answer. So we look into what is the core of the Buddhist teachings. Right? In fact, just now I was talking to what is talking to you is the core of it. And I like to talk about it. So it's that when you understand yourself and how your mind works, This understanding in itself is wisdom. Right? Because the Buddha says right understanding. Right? Just now I went with you, the three, of the mental part of the practice. Right? But this right understanding, you listen, you think, and then you practice, and what comes with the practice is that triple wisdom which we talk about. Like when you have this triple wisdom, then your thinking and all these things, it comes naturally. The goodness will come into you. And then the things which are not good will slowly disappear. Well, that is what we call wisdom. So it's nothing they can say, okay, I want you to sit down there and give you five hours lesson in wisdom. If I do that, I basically charge you and run away after that. Because you can't teach wisdom. I can give you informations. That's the first part of it. You can think about it, the second part, but you must be there to be able to bring yourself to understand things. Right? When you develop an understanding, that is the wisdom we talk about. And when you develop an understanding, whether you are from Europe, whether you're from Asia, the thinking are all the same. The wisdom is the same. Right? Buddha talks about it. That wisdom is like the taste of the seawater. It tastes salty. Right? Or wisdom is like taste of honey. It tastes sweet. It's the same taste. So anybody who practice will eventually arrive with the wisdom. And the practice is nothing more than develop mindfulness, develop concentration, develop effort. Look into the Eightfold Path. I've spoken to you about the precepts. That's on the sila. Right? I've spoken to you on right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. That's samadhi. Then eventually when you start to learn a lot of things and then get it from your experience, that is panya. Whether you come from Mahayana tradition, whether you come from a Theravada tradition, the eight things remains the same. Okay? Any other questions? We're running out of time. Okay, announcements.